done, I said.
The hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Subcommittee on Legislative Process Reform. And if there are members who are seated out in the audience, they're welcome to come down and sit at the table. We've invited the entire Minnesota House, all the caucuses are invited to attend and participate. I'm going to start with a statement about the purpose of the committee, and then hopefully from that statement we will then collect information and at some point we will act. But the purpose of the committee is this. It is to ensure that we take a look at a series of reforms that will allow us to uphold our constitutional responsibility of ending a Minnesota legislative session on time with a balanced budget. That is the primary goal of the committee. And when I say reforms, you're going to see a more expansive look at reforms than we even had in 2007 and in 2008. In 2007 and 2008, we had 8 hearings over the interim, 8. We may have 8 over this interim. We're going to take a look at the budget process. We're going to take a look at both the executive branch, and hopefully we will have at least the Senate listening in on what changes we need for House rules, Senate rules, joint rules, legislation, and there may even be a constitutional amendment involved in resolving the problems that we've had with finishing session on time with a balanced budget. So with that, we're going to start by having a presentation by nonpartisan staff.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I had my hand up.
Representative Carlson.
If you'll recall, when I chaired the Education Committee, I appointed you to chair a subcommittee on mandate reduction. And one of the things that you very wisely did was that you asked a couple of senators that you thought might be interested to sit in. And one of them, if I recall correctly, ultimately authored some of the legislation on the Senate side. I think it was Senator Murphy from Red Wing, if I recall correctly. If you haven't already, I would suggest if you know of anyone that's interested, and I'm just picking up on your comments, you hoped that the Senate would be listening. And perhaps there might be the equivalent of a Senator Murphy that would, I think he sat in on virtually every meeting that you held with that subcommittee. So that's just a comment.
Representative Carlson, apparently they can't hear you. Can you hear me?
No.
All right. So we've got a glitch somewhere. We'll pause until we figure out what the glitch is. Then I think I'll have Representative Carlson repeat your question. So I hope what we just had was recorded.
The silence is deafening.
Well, it is the interim.
Where's the pages?
Yeah. All the House members, come on down to the table. You don't need to sit out in the audience. Come on down. So if we have a House member that I've missed somewhere, let's make sure we invite them down. And if we had a senator, we would invite even a senator down. What's the status of our taping over there?
Looks like the media is prepared to tape anyway.
But we're not getting it through the... Are they getting it now? Can you hear me through the mic now?
Yeah. We just have to speak closer, maybe?
You've heard my teacher voice. I'd like to control the classroom with content rather than just with verbiage. So you've already heard it. Can you hear me now? Yes? So, Representative Carlson, why don't you repeat your question just and get the mic as close as you can.
Okay. I'll try to speak loudly. Chair Pawlowski, when you indicated that you hoped that the Senate would be listening, it helped me recall a number of years ago when I chaired the Education Committee, I appointed you to chair a special subcommittee on mandate reduction. And what you did at the time, you reached out to the Senate and asked if there were any senators that were willing to sit in, and Senator Murphy from Red Wing, I think, sat in on virtually all of the meetings and ultimately carried some of the legislation that your subcommittee proposed in terms of the reforms on the mandates in higher education. I was just picking up, I was just picking up on your comment that you hoped that some in the Senate would be listening. And my suggestion was, if you haven't done so already, that if you knew of any senators that might be interested in reform, that you perhaps invite them to sit in and or at least give notice that they would be welcome if some chose to. But that was just a suggestion based on the history that you and I had on that mandate subcommittee.
Representative Carlson raises an excellent point. There were two senators that have approached me at the end of the legislative session, one a Democrat, one a Republican, who expressed great interest in this. Subsequently, as I understand it, they have also talked to the Speaker's office. So the Senate, as you know, operates slightly differently than we do. But I'm hopeful that we will have senators also involved in this discussion, because they also understood what happened this legislative session and subsequently what's happened 17 times in the last 21 years to special sessions. So you raise an excellent point. And for people who don't understand or weren't here, in 97-98, Representative Carlson and then I did a series of hearings on mandate reduction for higher education. Governor Carlson was also involved in that, and that's why I raised the executive branch. Some of what we're going to be discussing today cannot happen unless we have the executive branch involved. So you're going to, in subsequent hearings, we're also inviting parts of the executive branch in for a discussion of how these reforms will have to be implemented at the executive branch, too, because this is going to be budget-driven, and it's a complicated process, and it's one that's going to take more than just one simple fix. There's no easy fix for this. It took us a while to get here. It's going to take us a while to get out. So, Representative Carlson, I appreciate that. And we may even have senators at subsequent meetings. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And with that, we have two individuals who have prepared. There's information in your packets. There's also information by the door. All of this is on the website under the Rules Committee. I want to thank all of the staff who's been involved in this, and I'm not going to do it necessarily by name, but the Rules Committee staff, the Greater Minnesota Committee staff, and the Agriculture Committee staff have all been involved in putting this together. So we have three different committees of staff working on this, and I want to thank them all. And they'll be with us throughout all of these hearings. So with that, I want to have the people at the table introduce themselves, welcome them to the committee, and then start their presentations.
Bill Marks, Chief Fiscal Analyst.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Patrick McCormick. I'm from House Research. I'm going to start off with a brief overview presentation, and then Bill's going to take it from there. I'm here with actually several nonpartisan staff. Our charge today is to provide background information about the legislative process. My testimony is in your packets, but I'm going to walk through it. My first point, I've got four major points. My first is just to note that our role here is to describe the current process. There are real limits to what role nonpartisan staff can play in a reform effort. From the viewpoint of a nonpartisan staffer, there's nothing wrong or right about the legislative process. And we actually train our new staff to accept the legislature as it is and to work within it. In line with that training, our role today is only to describe the current system. And we're about to outline some of the past reform efforts, and then we're going to talk in detail about the executive legislative budget system, perhaps ad nauseum. Our testimony will be technical in nature. In fact, you might become somewhat frustrated at our very descriptive testimony. This is because you are the decision makers, and we serve at your discretion, so we don't think it would be professional of us to advocate for any particular reform. In your packet is a report from the Committee on Legislative Process Reform. The report was made in August 2008. I'm not going to walk through the report in any great detail. It's something that you should take away and spend time with yourself. It was based on combined ideas from testimony at the 8 hearings that Representative Pawlowski outlined, including ideas from the NCSL and ideas actually from the members of the working group. In outline form, there are 4 sections. The first section talks about the committee structure and procedural reforms, which were considered at the time. The second section contains a range of possible floor procedure reforms. The third section outlines conference committee reforms, and the last has a series of miscellaneous ideas. If you look at this report, you'll see a number of reforms that one legislative body could adopt, and some of them have been adopted. However, most of the proposed changes would work best if the Senate and the House were in agreement. As you'll see when we discuss the budget in a minute, making most far-reaching changes to budgeting requires the governor, the House, and the Senate to acquiesce in a reform. Some reforms will require constitutional amendments. Since 2008, the legislature has adopted a number of changes to rules. Specifically, the House has adopted the following rule changes. In 2009, we adopted Rule 2.42. That gave the Rules Committee the power to establish and announce time parameters for consideration of bills on the floor. In 2009, we adopted Rule 6.40. That allowed Conference Committee reports to be available in both electronic and written format. Before then, it was only written formats. In 2011, we removed and struck Rule 2.42 and removed the power of the Committee of Rules to set time limits for floor debate. In 2011, we passed Rule 4.05, which is a budget rule, which establishes limits on budget amendments on the floor and in committee, on the floor specifically, sorry, when the budget resolution is not operative. In 2013, we added language that allowed bill introductions to be ended after a specific date adopted by the Rules Committee, but not earlier than May 1. So this gave the House the ability to say, after a date certain, no more bills can be introduced. In 2013, we adopted Rule 3.33. That is the infamous or famous pre-filing of amendments rule, and required and allowed amendments to be pre-filed and available the day before a floor action. In 2015, we adopted Rule 3.22. That established that for amendments to amendments, they could not raise a tax or a fee unless the underlying amendment also increased the tax or fee in question. That prevented a certain kind of bridge amendment on the floor where an amendment was offered and then another amendment actually raised a tax or a fee later on. In 2017, we adopted a rule that said that when we have a Senate send a bill over for concurrence, we couldn't just pick it up the moment it came from the Senate and pass it in and go off into law, that we had to slow down and wait 12 hours after the Speaker announces that the Senate has sent a bill over for concurrence. Some of these are ideas that were in the 2008 report, others were not. But in some senses, it tells you that time doesn't sit still and that we keep working. There have also been a lot of changes around the Capitol that have not come from rules changes or procedural changes. And it's important to note them. And in talking to the library who tracks these things, they have articles and databases about changes in the culture. But just for example, I take 1989, 30 years ago, as a comparative year. In 1989, there were 29 reporters in the Capital Press directory, and today there are 53 reporters. There were 1,174 lobbyists, and now there are 1,317 lobbyists. In 1989, and some of us, like Bill and I, were here in 1989, there was only just the very beginning of email. There were no Twitter, no social media. Meeting notices were tiny cardboard placards on bulletin boards. And in 2019, this is all trackable electronically. Most state agencies did not have legislative liaisons as a position. And today, many and most do have a formal position of legislative liaison. And today, you can pull up a bill in real time on the House or Senate webpage and read it in real time, or an amendment and read it in real time. Often, then, you would have to wait till the bills were printed, and after session, sometimes people would not have a bill for 2 or 3 days. I remember in the 1980s, when we wanted the news, a clipping service, which would come around later in the day, would clip out all of the newspaper articles from across the state that had to do with the legislature, and that's where you would often see things for the first time. And today, you just click on your phone. So it's a different culture, and the reforms that this committee considers have to fit into this new culture. And at the very least, there's a far more attention paid across the state of Minnesota to the Capitol.
Mr. McCormick, I'm just going to have you pause for a second. For folks who want to follow along in a literal form, there's a handout, Minnesota Research. He's on page 3 at the top. And if you want to follow along, he's sort of going bullet point by bullet point. So that would be also in the rack in the back, and it would also be on the website posted for the committee. So, Mr. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, members, today a group of nonpartisan staff is going to outline the structure of executive legislative budget preparation. The goal is to describe for you how budgets get built. And I want to emphasize that this is both budget making as a compilation of data and budget making as a series of organizational procedures to create a budget. And I get to make some preliminary comments. My first point is that each item in the overall budget requires its own unique and specific kind of data in order to get done. School enrollment, income tax collections, dozens and dozens of forecasted spending changes. And it's as a policy person, you can see that the budget rests on a structure of data collection about public programs. And this complex data-driven system requires MMB to merge the spending and revenue data in a timely manner. They have to get it merged to help the governor create a budget and the legislature enact a budget. And this is not a job that MMB just made up. MMB, I compliment them here, they're a nationally recognized agency, an award-winning agency. They do great work. But we, the legislature, helped design this process in statute. So it's not arbitrary. It's statutorily driven. And it's also designed by the governor through executive orders and through memos. As Bill Marks is about to lay out for you, this huge annual and biennial task is actually designed to create a decision period for the governor and for legislators, about 3 to 6 weeks each year, where final decisions must be made, where all the data is in hand and is distributed and hopefully understood, and decisions must be made in order to set up the next annual or biennial budget. And I say annual because we have the short year of the session coming this year, and we will make adjustments to the biennial budget. The chart posted here and in your packets and in a handout outlines an ongoing tension between four values. In creating a budget and looking at the literature on budgeting, it's pretty clear that budget making has to be efficient. The Constitution makes the legislature adjourn at a specific date. It's a goal to be transparent, to empower the people. The budget changes have to be acceptable. You, the legislature, has to vote 68 votes in the House, 34 votes in the Senate, and the governor has to sign it, and eventually courts have to determine that it's constitutional if there's a challenge. And finally, it's crucial that the budget be accurate, to get the right numbers so that when we do our work and budget, balance the budget, it's actually balanced in a real-world fashion. It's a constant trade-off. And I would add that there are actually different players within the system who live in one or more of these corners. For example, the state economist lives and works out of the corner of accuracy. It's her job to provide an accurate budget forecast, and that's her emphasis over timeliness, over political deal-making. And the press, for example, and public advocates worry about transparency, and that's, in some sense, their professional duty. But most of the budgeting literature would argue that any given bill, any given session, any given process lives somewhere in a competitive tug of war between these values. And I would argue that any given reform fits somewhere between these four values. The Minnesota Constitution also places parameters on budget making. The Flexible Sessions Amendment of the Constitution established a flexible biennial session. The session is flexible because each legislature may schedule its regular session meetings as it pleases. As long as a given biennial session does not exceed 120 legislative days or meet outside of the January to May period. The session is biennial because each legislature is allowed, although not required, allowed to meet both years of the biennium. This creates a real constraint on your work. You can't start before the January beginning, and you must adjourn by the May date. The second major and important constraint that the legislature and governor live within is a balanced budget requirement. The balanced budget requirement is not explicitly stated in the Constitution. Rather, it derives from the limits on borrowing contained in the Constitution. The state may issue debt only for specified purposes. Borrowing money to pay for a deficit at the end of the biennium is not an allowed purpose. Thus, the budget must be in balance at the edge of the biennium. And therefore, the legislature and the governor must establish a balanced budget. Nonpartisan staff were asked today to concentrate our efforts in presenting on the state budget process. Adopting a budget every 2 years is a complex cycle of budget making, and that is the focus and gist of Bill Marks' testimony.
Mr. Marks, before you start, we all have had teachers. We lost one Friday, didn't we? Mr. Marks was a student of Professor Jim Eddy at Winona State University. He was chair of the political science department, as was I. And I am sure if Professor Eddy was alive, he'd be watching this, and there would be a phone call or a handwritten note arriving at both of our offices. So,
most likely a note, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, you should have in your packets a handout that says calendar for biennial budget process, and it's 3 pages, and that's what I'm going to work off of. My attempt here is to take a biennium, the 2-year budget period, and just to lay out key dates throughout that biennium or even leading up to that biennium as to things that are specified in statute or just to make the budget process work. So this is for the fiscal 2021 biennium. It's for the biennium that just started July 1st. But we go back a year to June of 2018 when Minnesota Management and Budget initially sent out budget instructions to state agencies. for preparing that budget for fiscal year 20 and 21. And if anybody wants to go and look at those instructions, the website, they are still, those instructions are still on the MMB website at the link that's shown there. Then in the fall of 2018, agencies start submitting information to MMB. Leading up to November 30th, when MMB actually posts base budget information on the website, and then agency narratives and descriptions and performance information, it is all part of that base budget information that's that becomes available on the website, and that link is also there. And this is the base budget in this case is the budget as established. There's a definition in law of the base, which says it's the appropriation from the last year of the previous biennium carried forward, unless there's a change in directed to that in law. Then December 5th of 2018, the November 2018 forecast was released. And just as a note, that's the first forecast that has actual forecasted figures for fiscal 20 and 21 instead of planning estimates, and the first planning estimates for fiscal year 22 and 23, the tails years as we talk about them in the budgeting process. And the law requires that that November forecast be delivered by the end of the first week in December. January 8th, the legislature convened.
Mr. Marks, I'm going to just stop you for a second. The statement on the December 5th budget forecast, there's been discussion, and you've seen it already in the media, that the legislature should at least consider using this as the primary budget forecast and begin a budget process in January rather than waiting subsequently for the February or March forecast. I'm not asking for you to express an opinion on it, but this discussion has already started to take place. So this might be one that we will have in, as an ongoing discussion, that we would start the budget process literally in January, and we would use this number as our primary number. And then if there was a change, then adjustments would be made subsequently in March or February. So,
and Mr. Chair, on that point, I actually went back and looked because I remember a March forecast when I first started here. And up through 1993, the February forecast wasn't. It was a March forecast. And budgets were put together based on the November forecast and adjusted at conference committee time, which had its disadvantages, too, that that the House and the Senate put together budgets based on a November forecast and made adjustments in the conference committees. January 8th, the legislature convened. February 19th, the governor submitted his budget recommendations. And just a note here that the law allows a new governor additional time to submit a budget. Had it not been a new governor this year, the requirement would have been that the governor's budget recommendations would have been due January 22nd. It's the fourth Tuesday in January for a non-new governor, and the third Tuesday in February for a new governor. Then early to mid-March, bills to enact the governor's budget are introduced. February 28th, the February forecast was released. That was then the document that, as the chair mentioned, we used for putting budget information or budget bills together and basically assembling the budget for the in the 2019 session. The three committee deadlines mentioned here, March 15th, March 22nd, March 15th and March 25th, and then March 29th mentioned in here as the I got that wrong again. It's March 15th, March 29th, and April 12th were the three committee deadlines for committees to have bills moving. The March 22nd date shown on here is when the governor submitted revised budget recommendations to the legislature. These were changes in the governor's budget recommendations to fit with the February forecast. And just the note in the last sentence here, there is no statutory requirement for a governor to submit revised budget recommendations. That's been the practice for many years, but it's not required in law. The March 25th date at the bottom of the page, that's a requirement in House rule that the House, within 25 days of the February forecast, the rule says most recent forecast, must adopt a resolution that sets general fund net expenditures limits and limits for each major finance and revenue bill. And I made a note in here that the Senate rules require the Senate to do that within 30 days of the forecast. And then the note here, the House Ways and Means Committee did adopt a budget resolution on March 25th. The Senate leadership announced Senate targets later in that week, and I don't have the exact date on that. I already mentioned March 29th, the second deadline, and April 12th, the third committee deadline. Then April 13th to the 22nd were the break that the legislature took for Easter and Passover. And then the next three dates are something that was essentially new this year. The governor, the Speaker of the House, and the Senate Majority Leader released a memo announcing a May 1st, May 6th, and May 13th deadline. And these were deadlines, May 1st, for having major finance bills passed by the House and Senate and conference committees appointed. And the note here that that deadline was met for most finance, major finance bills. The legacy bill was later than that, and there was no capital expenditure bill. May 6th was the deadline in that memo for providing fiscal targets to chairs. That deadline was not met. And then May 13th was the deadline for chairs to complete conference reports in the House of Origin. That deadline was not met. May 20th, the requirement that the regular legislative session needed to end by midnight. The note here that one major bill, finance bill, did pass. The higher education bill was passed in both bodies by that deadline. May 24th was the one-day special session when most other bills were passed. So then we're moving into kind of what's in the future here. There is one deadline I forgot to put in here. I thought about it this morning. June 30th, the end of the biennium, the 18-19 biennium, and then July 1st would be the beginning of the new biennium. And that would be much more relevant if we were looking at not having budget bills passed and looking at shutdowns or so on, because at that point the state agencies and programs run out of money. So if I was doing this again, I'd add the June 30th date and the July 1st date in here. The July 15th date, proceeding on the budget cycle, law requires the capital budget requests to be released by MMB. So all the capital budget requests, and this is basically because the second year of the biennium, the second year of the legislative session, is looked at as the bonding year. Capital budget requests will be available on the MMB website on July 15th. And then October 1st of 2019, I added this in. This is a little bit unique this year. It has been done previous years, but it's not done every year. We have in legislation, in 2019 legislation, three kind of contingent appropriations. And the law states that when fiscal 2019 is closed, the closing balance is greater than was anticipated at the end of the 2019 session, then there are three different appropriations that, depending on how much money could occur. And so the law requires that to be determined by October 1st. October 10th, MMB will provide updated revenue information, not spending, but revenue information, for the first quarter of 2019, but also provides final fiscal 2019 revenue amounts. And again, important to note, this is revenue. This isn't spending, so it's not complete budget information. In early December of 2019, could be late November, but probably early December, MMB will release another budget forecast, the November 2019 forecast. In January 15th of 2020, the law requires the governor to release his capital budget recommendations. The legislature has set February 11th as the date when the 2020 legislature is going to convene. Late February of 2020, the February budget forecast would be released. Mid-March of 2020, most likely, the governor will issue supplemental budget recommendations. And again, the note, there is no statutory requirement that the governor do this. And then some speculation here, but late March and April deadlines for committees to take action. Late March of 2020, Ways and Means Committee may adopt a budget resolution. The House rule states in the second year of the biennium it's may adopt. It's not a requirement like in the first year. The dates for Passover and Easter, and then May 17th of 2020 is the last day that bills may be passed. May 18th is the last day the legislature may meet in 2020. So, Mr. Chair, members, that's a fairly quick run-through of what the biennial budget schedule looks like.
Mr. Marks, I'm going to go back for a second. When you said the deadlines were not met, if the deadlines had been met and the House had a rule that conference committee reports would have to sit for 24 hours before being taken up on the House floor, would we have been able to have accomplished that given those deadlines?
Mr. Chair, if the May 13th deadline had been met, the conference committees will provide completed conference reports in the House of Origin. That deadline, the 24 hours, should have been able to be met before May 20th.
But, Mr. Marks, it might have been a little tight.
It may have, but I'm also being cautious here because the House of Origin would be the House for House files. It would be the Senate for Senate files, and I can't guarantee what action would take place in those bodies.
Members, another discussion that is underway is having a 24-hour rule on conference committee reports before we take them up on the House floor. We had one at one time, and that would at least give us some breathing space on understanding what's in the conference committee report before you would take it up on the floor of the House. I'm not saying that's what we're going to do, but I think these are all things that we should start seriously considering as we begin to take a look at amending this process so it works in a much more productive way. So, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Marks, you referenced the time period when we did use the November forecast, and my recollection was that that put a new governor at a distinct disadvantage, being that you referenced the current situation with a new governor, in preparing a budget, that they would basically have to rely very heavily on the previous administration as far as their budget initiatives. And if I recall, I think we talked about sometimes they would do some fine-tuning, but it was difficult for them with those, by using the November forecast to really meet the timelines to develop their own budget, whatever that would be defined as being. Am I correct in my memory?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the governor currently has to use the November forecast to do the budget, so I don't know that that would put the governor necessarily at a bigger disadvantage, because even with the later governor's recommendations this year, that the February 19th recommendations, they were put, the governor's recommendations, initial recommendations were assembled on based on the November forecast, and then the governor a week later had to turn around and start revising the governor's recommendations because the new forecast had come out, or I guess it's more like 10 days later. But
well, maybe if I could reframe the question, I was going by memory because that's been several years, and I thought I remembered some discussion about the problem of putting a budget together with an incoming governor. Do you recall why we, Mr. Marks, moved away from the November forecast?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, members, I think the problem was more an issue of the House assembled a bill. The governor made recommendations based on a November forecast. The House assembled a bill based on the November forecast, and so did the Senate. And then if significant changes came in the February forecast, we were at a point where the conference committee had to deal with those changes, or leadership had to decide how to tell conference committees to deal with that. I recall an education issue at that time where the February March forecast rather changed rather significantly pupil unit numbers, and the education committee, which is where I was working at that time, was short about $40 million because there were more pupil units than had been projected earlier. And if you're in conference committee, the House has one position, the Senate has another position, the governor may have another one, and you've got to make up $40 million, which was the situation at that point. Those new initiatives or those changes that any of those bodies were making were going to suffer because of the dealing with the $40 million problem. And I wasn't in this position at the time, so I don't want to speak as though I was, but I think that was part of the problem, was getting to conference committee, then getting new numbers, and then having to adjust to those new numbers.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I remember in your initial presentation you referenced that the decisions ultimately would have to be made in in conference committee, and as you speak, I begin to recall some of those discussions at that point in time. Because then you had a smaller group of people making those decisions, and it hadn't really gone through the entire process in either body. All of a sudden, your example there, like the $40 million, was had to be handled in conference committee without any additional involvement. All right, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Marks, any response to that?
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct.
Okay. Representative, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski, and maybe appropriate to make a comment at this time when we're talking about this process. Anecdotally, in my lifetime, it appears to me that most governors in my adult life generally had problems with the legislature spending too much money, generally vetoing bills because they spend too much. And we have heard the phrase governor's recommendations, and it is that separation of powers that the budget process really, I believe, is all appropriations originate in the House. And it's appropriate to certainly listen to the governor's recommendations, but increasingly it seems as though governors veto bills today because they don't spend enough money. And so it seems to be a dynamic, and it seems like oftentimes the separation of powers between the legislature and the governor seem to get mired a little bit on this issue, and it's frustrating to me, at least at a minimum. Thank you.
Representative, I share your frustration, and I would hope in this committee that we would all of us, including the governor, rise above partisanship for once and take a look at what's happened here the last 20 years and then say we need to make some adjustments here. And partisanship should not be the primary consideration. It should be the good of the state. So I agree with you in a way, but that's going to be some tough sledding, too, very tough sledding, given what's happened. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is to Mr. Marks. When you were talking about the $40 million that was in the education budget that year, if we had had complete budget information at that October 10th date, would that $40 million have been recognized at that time?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Calderon, I don't recall the details of that, and I think updated pupil unit numbers, and remember that reporting wasn't quite as prompt 30 years ago as it may have been now. But I do remember that the Education Committee afterwards had a hearing on how the Department of Ed collected pupil unit data and so on. But it was an issue of there were better numbers available at that time, and because the forecast didn't come in until March, they were in that March forecast, and we wanted to recognize those numbers at that point.
Yeah. Representative?
Follow up, please.
Sure.
Then would you think it would be a better process to include the complete budget numbers, both revenue and expenditures, or do you think it would be all right to continue as we currently are?
Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chair, the forecast currently does include both the revenue and the spending numbers. They are never complete because we're in the process of doing it, and they always, like education numbers, aren't complete until after the school year is over, and we know how many pupil units there actually were or how much spending actually occurred, and it's some point after the school year is over. So, it should be both spending and revenue numbers, and I think we currently do that as far as the way the forecast would work.
Okay. I just understood you to say that we did not do that. We only looked at revenue and not complete budget information. So maybe that was my misunderstanding.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if I said if it sounded that way. I didn't mean to say that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Shifting back to Mr. McCormick.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, it might be worthwhile just to mention that one reason why the February forecast is valuable is because we get crucial new data that may not be available in the November forecast. So, for example, December sales tax revenues, which key into how good of a holiday season we've had, might be crucial information, especially if we're shifting from a surplus situation to a potential recession, that's another fact for the legislature to take into account. And, or we get new revenues, but we also get new data about the national economy. So this is going back to the competing values, accuracy. If we did a May 1 forecast, it would arguably be more accurate than a February forecast. It just would be incredibly inefficient because we could never get our budget done. And that's why designing the forecast structure does feed into real human decision-making abilities. How fast can you turn around a new fact and incorporate it into the decision-making? Our next, and one of our purposes here is to talk about the budget making in layers. And so I've referred to the fact that we need different kinds of data and that, in fact, each specific area might generate a different kind of data. The data that you get from higher ed institutions is vastly different than the data you get from K-12 organizations. Property tax data is a lot different than the healthcare expenditures in the human services budget. We turn all of this, we the legislature, turn all of this data and all the governor's recommendations into legislation. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. We have to have a bill for an act, and the bill for an act has to appropriate money by law. And we use omnibus bills as our vehicle or our method of adopting a budget. Now, omnibus bill is a phrase that has become a dirty word in some circles. A non-budget omnibus bill, for example, a bill that regulates realty law, a bill that regulates the banking omnibus bill, data practices, pipeline safety, there are dozens of familiar lands bill, hunting and fishing bill. They're designed to let the legislature co-locate all decisions affecting a statute or a body of law in one place. It allows us to be consistent. It allows the decision makers to see, today we're dealing with all of the decisions that relate to expenditures related to pipeline safety. Today we're doing all the policy provisions related to banking. So it's a method of hanging our decisions together in one package. Budget omnibus bills are known in rule as major finance and revenue bills. You can spend money outside of a budget omnibus bill. You can have a one-off appropriation, but all of our major finance and revenue bills are parceled out by rule. There are 12 categories, there are 12 kinds of budget bills. The 12 categories are established by House Rule 4.03. The same 12 categories are created under Senate Rule 7.3. We argue or line up particular accounts, which may be parceled out among these 12 categories differently each year, but those are the 12 budget bills that we adopt to create a budget. These categories can be changed. There's not a constitutional requirement that we have 12 bills or 10 bills. We could have 20 bills. We could have 5 bills. Secondly, and I want to note, we don't have to do the budget the way we do. It's a technical term, which at some later point people can talk about, but there are states that do a base budget and then later a change item budget. We do a base plus change item budget in one package, one bill. Our method, having 12 omnibus bills, is legal and is in general blessed by the courts. The Constitution's single subject rule is broadly interpreted in Minnesota. These are all bills to fund state government. In consonant with our decision to try to present to you the layered effect of making a budget, each of these bills uses the budget data particular to their area and works with specific state agencies and commissioners in their area. As a person who's staffed more than one omnibus bill, it's important to note they all have their own culture. They have their own traditions. They have their own history and their own best practices. When I became director of House Research, everybody told me that the K-12 bill does it their way. And I have staffed a K-12 bill or once in my life, and I know they do it their way. The tax bill does it their way. And it's not arbitrary. They're not making up a unique way to do things. They have different constraints, different ways data are presented, different ways that they have to write their budget. Why is the HHS bill so long? Why do we go some years without even having a tax bill? Why is K-12 data-driven and formula-driven and uses fiscal notes in an entirely less common way than other bills? One starting point for budget reform is understanding that not all omnibus bills are the same. We want today's staff to talk about the unique data and culture of three of the bills. We could have picked any three randomly, but we chose three of the big ones that drive our budget decisions each year and that are problematic some years, all years, but that we can't do a budget without these three bills. And it couldn't be more different, and the people who staff them couldn't be more different. So we have three different teams to just briefly talk about the uniqueness of their areas.
Mr. McCormick, before we do that, can you go back and explain the difference in a base budgeting approach?
Mr. Chair, it would be that the base budget is in place, and it might be enacted early in session, or it might be enacted in statute. Where there's a base budget in place and that continues on, and the legislature then is making changes to that. If it's a statutory base budget, then the legislature is only dealing with changes to that base budget each year or each biennium. If it's a situation where the legislature might come in January and enact a base budget, and remembering that the definition of base in our case would be the appropriation for the last year of the previous biennium, unless that was a one-time appropriation or unless the base is stated differently. So that might get enacted in January, and then the legislature would concentrate on what changes do we want to make to that base? Do we want to increase some things? Do we want to eliminate some things? Do we want to decrease some things? Do we want to repurpose some things? That would all be done in the change bill.
Mr. Marks, this has also been discussed over the last few years as a possible alternative to the way we do budgeting now. And I bring it up because it would be a unique way of understanding your limits before you decided to make changes. And I think there is a sometimes lack of understanding of what the limits are inside these budgets when you are then beginning to dump thousands of bills into a system to make changes in budgets where you don't understand what the base of the budget actually is. I raise it as a point because this should be about budgeting, and it shouldn't be about simply passing bills. And these budgets are complicated. They have ramifications, as we found out in the last legislative session, that ripple and are going to be addressed probably in the next legislative session. So this base budgeting concept is something that's also been discussed and hopefully will continue to be discussed as an alternative to what we do now. Mr. McCormick. I'm sorry, Representative Cotton.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. And kind of on that point, something that I know you've worked on or spoke of in the past is the number of bills that are originated and introduced in total and also per member in some ways. And obviously there's probably some controversy if we limit the number of bills that legislators could introduce, but it's certainly a topic that's worth maybe discussing a little bit. But I was wondering if Mr. McCormick could comment a little bit on the volume of bills that are introduced and the workload that comes from the revisor's office. My kind of concern a little bit is, perhaps bills that are introduced not by legislators that, either special interest or lobbyists or other departments and what, if you have to give us an idea of what percentages are introduced by legislators and other lobbyists call you up and say, yeah, so-and-so I talked to, and you can introduce the bill or work on this, and how that would affect kind of more at the beginning point and then ending up to where we pass an actual budget as opposed to just trying to pass bills.
Mr. McCormick.
And at a later date, I can provide data going back some years, or the revisor can provide data going back some years. It's important to note that under the current system, bills are all introduced by a member. A member has to sign on as a chief author of a bill. And the bills arrive in a member's hand in a variety of ways. And in new member training, we talk about the substantive ways. One is that the governor and executive branch agencies submit bills, and they submit them by rule after the February forecast. And those bills arrive and are available for introduction. They don't have to be introduced if no member wants to do that. And the second major source of bills are lobbyists representing principals. And a principal could be a child care association, they could be a library, they could be a school, they could be a hospital, they could be a major corporation, they could be a hedge fund. So I never want to judge lobbyists and principals. They might, you know, be our next door neighbor who's helping poor people. They might be somebody who wants to make a fortune for their particular company in their community. Another source are activists and people, citizens, who have ideas of changing the system. Dozens and dozens of times, people forward an email to me saying, a constituent would like a bill to take a look. I got three this morning. And then finally, your ideas. Members come here and they want bills. They want amendments. They want to change the world. These bills cycle through a committee and are assigned to a committee, but they're drafted by our office, House Research, and they're drafted by the Advisor's Office, and they're drafted by Senate Counsel and Research. And our workload picks up in November, when you're after the election specifically, and through December, and then peaks in January, February, March, when the committee deadlines are approaching. You want your bill introduced in advance of the committee deadlines because you want it to pass, and it falls precipitously in April and May. And this year in May, we did very few bills. We do amendments. And the revisor switches to amendments because bills are alive or dead. And if you have a great idea, you need an amendment on the floor or in committee. I'm an agnostic on whether we have too many bills or not. So do you have an idea?
Representative Kostick, you wish to say anything more?
Well, yeah, I thank you for the discussion. And I think maybe if we talk to members, sometimes we go to get a bill introduced and, you know, it takes a little bit longer than what we would normally think, you know, maybe 2 weeks and when you're in the middle of session. So it's just something that maybe I'll
Representative Kostick, in the presentation that Mr. McCormick did earlier, he had some numbers of the increase in lobbyists and other things. I would have added to that the increase in the number of bills. We've set records again this session. I want to remind members of a statement that was made by Brenda Erickson from the National Council of State Legislatures in the first two hearings we had in December. I think it was Representative Freiberg who had brought up a discussion about the bills and the so-called ownership of these bills. She was emphatic that these are not members' bills. When these bills are introduced, they belong to the state of Minnesota and to the people. And when we take possession of them, that becomes a problem too. It isn't our bill. It's the people's bill. And we're trying to do something for Minnesota. It is not our bill. And that possession problem has come up, as you've seen in committee, and on the House floor. So that's another issue, too. I would argue that we have lost focus on our constitutional responsibility of the budget, and we have refocused on hearing members' bills. That's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to pass a balanced budget. That's the responsibility, and we have failed in it multiple times. Mr. McCormick, who's Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just to make a comment on the number of bills, some members may not necessarily recall, but we used to limit the authorship to 5 members on a bill. And that led to a proliferation of what we call clones, people on both sides of the aisle. So when we expanded the authorship, I think it's, 30 or 35 now, the idea was to eliminate the proliferation of clone bills, and that hasn't worked out exactly like it was initially thought, because we still have a lot of clone bills coming from both sides of the aisle in a bipartisan, nonpartisan comment. That was an attempt. Now, I think in the U.S. Congress, and maybe Mr. McCormick can correct me if I'm wrong, I think they have no limit on the number of authors on a bill, at least in one of the two bodies. I'm not necessarily advocating we expand it to potentially all 134 members being on a single bill, but just repeating a little bit of the history there where we've tried to wrestle with that to eliminate at least the clones, and that didn't work out very well in the end. But if Mr. McCormick could comment, is there a limitation at the upper end, or are there legislative bodies that allow for more signatories on a bill than what we do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, House Rule 1.12 limits the House to 35 authors, or 35 co-signatories, one chief author and 34 co-authors to a bill. You're right, in Congress you can have as many as possible. Most legislatures don't want an unlimited number because it begins to look like passage by subscription. So if you had 68 signatures on a bill, it would look like, well, we have a majority for this bill, and it would create a incentive for members to go around, and then they would say, look, we have 91, why are you not releasing this bill? Why are you not passing this bill? And that's an extra constitutional, extra legal process that most legislatures feel it doesn't have a place.
Representative Carlson.
I wasn't necessarily advocating for it. It was just acquiring information. But what comes to mind when you said that that might create the perception that you already had all the necessary votes, 35 authors plus one clone is 70. Same thing. Again, I'm not advocating that, just pointing out that we've tried to wrestle with that issue in a variety of ways through the years.
Representative Roman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the budget process. I guess my question. Maybe I've forgotten. do we? I've often thought that the legislature was to serve somewhat as a management review process, be managers of what state government is doing, management review of the programs, and I don't ever really see that we. Once a program is in the can, there's never any return to it, at least by the legislature. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the legislature's role is not to be an overall manager and do management review.
Representative
Oversight. Yeah, management oversight. Is that?
Representative, I'm going to go back to a statement Representative Carlson made earlier in reference to what I had done in 97-98. In 97-98, when I was chairing higher ed, we did comprehensive mandate review and reduction, and we were working with Governor Arne Carlson at the time. It took an entire interim to put together a proposal, working with the governor, that we would then pass, and Senator Murphy, as you alluded to, was the author on the Senate side that did it. This is rare, though. Now, if you recall, Governor Dayton tried to have an unsession in that second term, and it didn't quite work out the way he wanted, but I concurred with his philosophy that we should spend at least one of these sessions on reviewing what we've done and eliminating things that are out of date, that clearly don't work anymore, and that they should be removed from the statutes. I think that should become a hand-in-hand. So I agree with you. There have been attempts in the legislature. Representative Carlson literally had a mandate reduction committee underneath his, what I think it was Ways and Means at the time, or was it higher?
Or no, it was finance.
Finance. Yeah. And I concur with it. I think there should be that type of ongoing review, and it should exist because some of these programs have been around for 30 years. Well, 30 years ago, it was a different environment, and the program either needs to be changed or eliminated, and those resources put somewhere else. I concur. So that's partially up to us if we want to do it, and to leadership if they're going to allow us to do it. Now, I would say this committee is an example of it, too. We had two hearings in December. The decision was made to strictly enforce the rules, and I had stated before that we would have hearings in the interim once, and particularly because we had an influx of new members who hadn't experienced the process. Well, I think they've experienced now, and they have a pretty good idea of what happens when we go into the not-so-special special sessions. So I concur with you, but I think that's up to us, and that's pushing all of the caucuses to say that we need that type of an environment. And the environment is equally important to passing bills as it is to reviewing things and undoing them when they need to be undone.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, we have three very brief presentations from three very different omnibus bills.
And these are in the packets also. I think they're labeled by the different presentations. So there's the Omnibus Tax Committee, Omnibus Health and Human Services. So whoever's going to be up first.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Doug Berg. I'm the fiscal analyst for the Human Services Committee in the House, and we're going to kick it off. Mr. John and I will talk a little bit about the Human Services bill and budget process, and we're going to try to just highlight a little bit, generally speaking, the things that Mr. McCormick and Mr. Marks outlined apply to all of the budget areas, but there are some things about human services that maybe are unique or are of note as it goes through. You should have a back and front page, one-page item in your packet that I'll work from. And just generally on the budget process and timelines, the thing that is probably most notable about human services is the size and complexity of the bills in the spreadsheet. It is commented on every year. Our bill coming out of the House this year was over 1,000 pages long. The final bill was nearly 700 pages. The spreadsheet is 40 pages long. It's a large, complex bill. It encompasses a lot of programs, a lot of subjects, a lot of money, a lot of policy. So that just requires it, the virtue of the size and the complexity create time pressures and staffing pressures that you have to acknowledge are different from other bills. I'd also note that in some years, and this was one of them, there are multiple bills. Mr. McCormick mentioned that there are 12 omnibus bills in the rules that we could do it differently. In fact, we do it differently to some degree. There was one omnibus human services bill, but there were two other major human services finance bills in play at the end, the vulnerable adults bill and the opioids bill. And so the interplay between those is something that affects the budgeting and the decision-making process. Again, that can be done in multiple ways and has been done in multiple ways. The structure of the House matters. There are currently two subcommittees that feed into the Human Services Finance Committee to do its work. Those committees have to finish their work for the omnibus bill to be done. This year both handled it in different ways. One chose to forward whole bills as their work product, and another chose to create a division report. That affects how we proceed and on the timeline we can proceed. And there are a lot of pieces of the human services bill that tend to need to go to other committees, and that when it's well organized, separate bills will go off to the Data Practices Committee or the Judiciary Committee or the GovOps Committee. Or, as was the case this year, we had a major tax item that caused the entire bill to go to the tax committee originally, and then at the end that was put in a different bill. And those kinds of decisions make a big difference in how the timeliness and how easy it is to move bills around and get them done. As far as data goes, human services is a big consumer of the revenue forecast, and that'll, I would point out, as being kind of one of the, maybe it's the most important thing in human services of the various budget areas. Human services has a large number of forecasted programs and a lot of money in it, and I have a couple of supplemental sheets that I'll just briefly refer to. If you look, there are three pages of just numbers, and the one that is numbered page one at the bottom is the cover page of the DHS revenue forecast for revenue and spending forecast for November, February rather. And you'll note the various programs there. There are about 10 or 12 programs that Human Services have that are forecast. And so we need to know what the base of those programs is to work off. And just as an illustration of the amount we're talking about, if you look fairly about two-thirds of the way down the page, there is a bolded line, net general fund expenditures. And you'll see these numbers are in thousands. This is Human Services, that for 20 and 21, we have about $6.4 billion general fund that are affected by the revenue forecast. That is in the vicinity of a third of the state general fund budget. So I'm trying to just emphasize how important the revenue forecast is in Human Services. And it affects, you know, how much is on the bottom line for other divisions to spend. And if the forecast is going the wrong way, it affects how much the legislature needs to come up with if we are in a situation of cutting the budget. These forecasts in Human Services is pretty complicated. It tracks what the current law projection is, but that is changed by eligibility changes that are in law, that come into law, and according to prior past legislation, by according to federal regulation may change, frequently happens. It also looks at utilization of services. How many people do they think are going to show up for medical assistance or the foster care program or any of our forecasted programs, and that can change substantially from forecast to forecast. And again, as my second page of numbers, the second and third pages, the ones that are labeled 2 and 3, are just meant to give you a little bit of an illustration of the size of this in the state budget. The one that's labeled page 2 is the change from prior forecast page out of the February forecast. And again, if you go to the bolded net general fund expenditures line about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way down, you'll see, and if you added that up, you'll see that in February the forecast showed a change to the state's overall projected spending over a six-year period of $158 million, roughly. But if you look to show how this can be different depending on when you do this in the process, page 3 is the same display for the November of 18 revenue forecast. And that, even though it shows only change for 4 years, and that's because the November forecast is the first one that has 22 and 23 on it, so there's no change in that those set of numbers because they weren't there in the prior February. Those 4 years show a change in last November of $735 million. You know, those are very substantial changes to the overall budget, and are to Mr. McCormick's point, sort of the accuracy is good, and you need to know this, so you're trading off, when you do this, you're trading off accuracy versus timeliness. And it's an important thing in Human Services because it swings a lot of money. And changes in Human Services, even federal decisions, tend to have large price tags. The last thing I'll note about the process is that Human Services is also a very large consumer of fiscal notes, the largest consumer of fiscal notes. In each house of the legislature typically asks for over 100 fiscal notes each session. The timeliness of fiscal notes can be an issue. We need them to, you know, the Human Services spreadsheet rolls up changes by budget activity, and we really need fiscal notes to do that. It can be a problem getting fiscal notes in a timely fashion with as many and as complex as they are. We deal with multiple funds, federal rules and regulation. There's extensive IT consideration. Almost everything that is done has an impact on systems, so reprogramming and the timeliness of that are things that impact the timeliness of fiscal notes and the complexity. And generally, the agencies do not have the resources to complete every fiscal note request that is put in, but there is a great deal of work by staff at all levels in the agencies to prioritize the work that is necessary to put together budget bills. But how that all happens affects the workflow and the timeliness of the production of the bills. But as Mr. McCormick said, we're servants of the process, and so whatever process is in place, we use these tools to get to the end result. And I guess that's where I would stop.
Mr. Burr, you've already alluded to the size of this bill. In the last two sessions, we've had extraordinarily large omnibus bills. Is there a way to break this bill up into some type of coherent parts that would be more manageable and at least somewhat easier to understand than to have one large bill with not only the numbers that you show here, but the size of the bill itself?
Mr. Chair, I'll leave. I think Mr. Chun is going to talk a little bit about sort of why the bill is the size it is, but just generally I'll comment that, as I mentioned, there were multiple bills this year. There were, in fact, five human services spending bills this year, so to some degree we are breaking it up by subject, but again, there isn't, I think, an inherently right or wrong answer to that. The bill could be done in a different way than it is. It has been handled in different ways in the past. Sometimes there is more policy in it than other years, but again, I don't know that there's a correct answer to that question.
Mr. Bergen, I'm not going to have you answer it, but you alluded to other bills. And there is a discussion now about having more individual bills coming to the House floor. Some of those would be budget bills. They'd be much smaller than the one we're looking at here, but they would be budget bills carried by members, and there was a time when at least some of that was done. So as we're considering different resolutions, having more bills, smaller bills, coming to the House floor might be one way to do it. And I'm not asking you to respond, but Mr. Chun, are you next on the? Okay. Okay, Representative Carlson.
I'll wait for Mr. Chun.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the
Mr. Chair and members, Randy Chun with House Research. I'll continue by briefly going over the process of assembling an omnibus spending bill and also talk about the length of the Health and Human Services bill. So first, the process of assembling the HHS omnibus bill is similar to that, I think, used in other budget areas. Bills are heard and amended during the committee process. They may be laid over by the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Then during the deadline weeks, staff are told by the chair which laid-over bills should be included in the omnibus bill. Staff may also, at the request of the chair, draft new proposals to include in the omnibus. Because the language in the HHS bill is often so complex and technical, House research staff normally work closely with agency staff on amendments to clarify or correct provisions in the bill. One unique feature of the bill that's been commented on is its length relative to other budget bills. And there are several reasons for the length of the HHS bill. The first is that the HHS committee has jurisdiction over a wide range of policy areas. These include, but are not limited to, health care, mental health, chemical dependency, income maintenance, social services, health occupations, public health, HMO regulation, and also nursing homes and long-term care. A second reason is that the statutory language governing programs that are administered by the Department of Human Services can be quite detailed and lengthy. These provisions often specify quite detailed criteria related to recipient eligibility, program services, covered benefits, provider reimbursement, federal compliance and how a program is to be administered. So what this means for practical purposes is that a large number of provisions need to be added to create a new program, or a large number of existing law provisions need to be amended to modify an existing program. In contrast, the statutory language for programs that's administered by the Minnesota Department of Health tend to be less detailed and shorter in length. And then a third reason is that the HHS omnibus bill also contains, at times, policy provisions that are not directly tied to money. Sometimes these provisions are included because the agencies weren't able to have all their policy bills heard on time, or sometimes there's little legislative interest in having separate agency policy bills. So the large size of this bill means that it can take a considerable amount of time for House research and reviser staff to assemble the bill, to process and process engrossments, and also for paper copies of the bill and engrossments to be printed. So this is something that is usually factored in when setting the schedule for committee and floor action on the HHS omnibus bill. And Mr. Chair, that concludes the, I guess, the HHS portion of this presentation.
Mr. Cheng, do you recall how many bills were referred to the Health and Human Services Committee this session?
Mr. No, I don't have that. We'll have to get back to the committee on that.
Mr. Berg, would you know how many bills were referred?
Mr. Chair, I don't. We can get back to you on that.
Okay. Would 500 be a ballpark number?
I don't know. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. That sounds a little high to me, but maybe to between the policy committee and I'm not sure.
Mr. Young, when you said bills are laid over, you wouldn't happen to know how many bills were laid over and then how many of those laid over bills were ultimately included in the omnibus bill?
Mr. Chair, that's also something we'll have to try to go back and see if we can.
I think we might revisit this with those numbers to get a better idea of the totality here of what the committee's dealing with. And I'm going to go back again to some type of a practical way of dividing this up so that it could be in an understandable format when it comes to the House floor rather than 1,000-page bill. So we'll revisit this. Representative Fred.
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
you were just putting food to your mouth. Okay. Representative Carlson.
When I looked over here, I thought.
I
even have my hearing aid in, so I guess I have that one.
Representative Carlson.
Sometimes I don't have them in, and then I miss the point. But at any rate, I was just sitting here recalling with, the sheer size of that bill. At one time, the division responsibilities were terms of change, but it was called Health, Welfare, and Corrections. I don't recall whether they reported out a separate corrections bill or not, or whether that was all part of their omnibus bill. I guess we'd have to look back and see just how that operated. But the division responsibility were three major accounts. And with some restructuring a number of years ago, that was changed. But we had a recent speaker who commented about separating the human service part from the health part of the bill. And so my question of either of the two staff people, Mr. Chung or Mr. Berg, would be how complicated would it be to separate on the face of it health issues and human service issues? Because in my recollection, some of those do interact fairly closely. But whichever one of you could take that with a brief response.
Mr. Berg, you want to.
Mr. Chair, I think there are complications to that. On the face of it, the budget, there's a health department budget and a DHS budget. I think it's more when you get into the policy side, you have things that frequently will affect both budgets. And then you have to find a way to effectively track what's happening and make sure you're getting, if something affects both the departments and it's in two places, that you make sure you have both parts of it. So it's doable, but there are interactions that complicate it.
Sam Carlson.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I don't recall the detail other than I think it was Speaker Thiessen. I think it was after he was Speaker, raised that question of looking in that direction at least, but nothing seemed to have ever come of it at that point. Other question I would have, quite frankly, one of my frustrations, Mr. Berg, when you referenced fiscal notes, was when when I was chair previously of the umbrella committee, the finance committee, as we called it, one of the problems was getting the fiscal information necessary for us to take it up in the full committee from the division in a timely manner. Fiscal notes were delayed, and we needed them to put the bill together. There seemed to be less of that this time. So in your judgment, being that you've staffed that committee for some time now, Mr. Berg, did the fiscal notes side improve this last session? Because it didn't seem to surface as a big problem with full ways and means.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I guess I would judge that it went fairly well this year. I can think of a couple of bills that where fiscal notes were still pending when they got to the Ways and Means Committee after having left the Human Services Division. Those tended to be more minor bills, and in I think a couple of cases we were waiting for fiscal notes that said it just confirmed that there was no cost to something where it was iffy. But generally, there's a lot of the fiscal note system we have works reasonably well, and there is a lot of work between the staff and the agencies and MMB to manage the workflow and make it clear what products we're going to need when. I will comment that laying out what legislative committees are going to take up when is very valuable to having an orderly process, but that can't always happen.
Now, Representative Carlson. Chairman, my perception, I was asking about the omnibus bill, when we would be waiting to meet the deadlines for the omnibus bill, and there would be a problem with getting fiscal notes so that the bill would be ready for Ways and Means or finance historically, and it seemed better this time, and I just wanted to know, being that Mr. Berg referenced the sheer number of fiscal notes, whether his perception was the same as mine. Thank you.
Representative Cousy.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was notified by staff your question earlier about how many HHS bills. Apparently, there was 267 finance bills introduced and 285 policy bills for a total of 552.
So my recollection was
we're pretty close.
Fairly accurate there.
Yep.
That's a significant number of bills for one committee, or even one committee and a couple of subcommittees to handle. That's a lot of bills. Mr. Chung or Mr. Berg, are you finished? Or
yes. Yeah.
All right. So, I'm sorry. Who else do we have here? Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The volume of work in this committee, maybe education committee, several others, major policy areas, how it comes to the committee seems to me to be something we could work on, which is that maybe there's a way to know from the committee members, okay, what are the areas to tackle? Because right now it seems like the problem solving is little bill by little bill. Do we have ever a big picture of, how this area needs attention and what should be the focus, particularly for this legislative session? So I think the problem-solving aspect is completely, disregarded. How do we define the problems and in what, ranking and rating and so on before, dumping hundreds and hundreds of bills on people?
Representative Rumbeck, and that's why I asked Mr. McCormick to better define, and Mr. There are others that defined it too, the base budget concept.
Yeah, right.
You start out with a base number and you work off that number.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there has to be some realization here that there are limits to all of these budgets. And you're not just, it's not a blank check. So within those limits, how are you going to deal with 500 and some bills, half policy, half finance, given whatever the budget is of health and human services? So there is an issue. Who else had that? Representative.
Mr. Chair, my concern is somewhat similar. When you're looking at Health and Human Services, we would want to be making sure that we're spending our dollars in the most prudent way to take care of the entire picture or the need that the state would have. And I would be concerned if we just divide the divide Health and Human Services for the sake of making smaller committees to look at a fewer number of bills, that we may have one committee who is saying we can do this health situation and another committee saying, well, we won't allocate dollars to food. Or food might be a bad example, but to some other need that really should be working in concert. But because they're being looked at separately, we're not seeing the bigger picture. So to the larger picture, I think we have to say what is our goal and what is our value for the state, and then to try to see how we would formulate the committees that way.
Representative, you make an excellent point, and I'm going to go back again. Unless you understand the budgets you're dealing with, it's very hard, I think, to make that point. And I think we've operated in many cases without any type of understanding of the budgets that are before us until we get to the end of session. And then in wonderment, we go, well, we didn't know that. We should have known it from the beginning. Gentlemen, are you two finished?
And yes.
All right. Mr. McCormick, who's next? Oh, K-12, the easy one. Welcome to the committee, and I think there's a handout on K-12 also in our packets.
Mr. Chair and members, before Mr. Strom dives into the bulk of the K-12 presentation, I just wanted to give the committee some context.
Please.
My name is Emily Adrians. I'm the House Fiscal Analyst for the K-12 Committee, and I wanted to sort of mimic some of the numbers that Mr. Berg was giving you for HHS. K-12 art, Mr. Strom will talk about the fiscal note needs of the K-12 committee. They're a bit different. And so for the fiscal notes, our need is more, it's probably like a third of what HHS requires from MMB. So we can do a little bit more of that work on our own. But similarly to HHS, the forecasted programs, K-12 has about 29 forecasted programs in the budget area, and what that amounts to for a biennial total, it's close to $15 billion out of the $20 billion that is spent in the K-12 area. So just to give some of that, some of the scope of the amount of spending that happens in the area.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Tim Strom from House Research. You've got a two-page document in your packets. We don't want to just read that for you, and I thought what might be most helpful is to make some comments about each of those sections as we go through and also build upon the things you heard about earlier. One thing I'd like to start with in the K-12 area, as the chair described, K-12 is a little bit of a different area. The majority of K-12 spending is actually on base budget. About 70-some percent of K-12 spending is through the general education program, and that program has an open and standing appropriation, and whether you as legislators finish your deliberations or not, the per pupil funding at the statutorily established level continues whether or not you act each year. So K-12 is a bit of a hybrid. There's a substantial portion that's actually a base budget funded amount. The second point I'd like to make in terms of the overview is the relative modest size of the K-12 bill. Compared to the Health and Human Services bill, the K-12 bill is often 200, 250 pages each year, relatively smaller. There's a few reasons for this. One of those is drafting style. This in part is, I think there are some other underlying reasons for this, but one of these is that much of the K-12 code is broken up into relatively small subdivisions. So to make a change to something may only require a paragraph or six or eight lines of statute, whereas in the Health and Human Services area, you might see 10 pages in a row with no change to existing statutory language until you get to page 11 and see that change on that page. So certainly drafting style and the history of how provisions came to be can lead to the relative size of bills. There are other ways one could proceed other than our current statutory amending system, but I think there are many reasons why our current system is a good one with the way that this legislature works.
In terms of bill variations, I want to add a couple of comments here. Not just the structure of the bill is an issue, but the structure the House and the Senate choose for committees are also an issue. For example, in the current biennium, the House has two education committees, an education policy committee and an education finance committee, and it also has an early education committee as well. The Senate, on the other hand, has one committee that deals with these three subject areas. So one thing to think about is even if the House were to say, let's have a separate omnibus education finance bill, a separate education policy bill, and a separate early education bill, what might happen under the current structure is when these bills come to conference committee, the Senate would say all three of those will be in one conference committee with our chair, and the end result may be that all three are rolled together there as well. So even beyond the structure and rules of the House, one must think about how the other chamber is configured and how they're going to prefer or desire to negotiate bills as well. In terms of statistics, very few House bills pass as individual bills any longer. Some years, a half a dozen or so may pass as individual bills, but generally, the policy and the finance are combined into one omnibus bill. There have been years, and some recent years, where a separate policy bill has passed, either one body or the other, but generally speaking, most of the subject matter related to education, both budget and policy, have been combined into a single bill. The next thing I'd like to mention is timelines, and there's two issues I want to mention here. The first of these is that the K-12 area is dependent on data that's collected by the Department of Education, and that data is from school districts, and as you talked about with forecasts, for a number of reasons, the data for K-12 is much, much better for the February forecast than it is in the November forecast. Now, this alone may not be a reason to drive a process, but something to keep in mind that the quality of that data due to the collections timelines is relatively better in the February forecast. The next thing I want to say about timelines, which is a little bit of a deviation from what's on the printed matter here, is never forget that time and timelines are a negotiating tool or weapon. Regardless of how one sets deadlines and the reasons behind deadlines, as bargaining goes on, those of you that are familiar with bargaining know that time is a weapon. And for that reason, timelines, even the most well-intentioned timelines, might be pushed to the limits every year with one side or the other hoping to achieve a negotiating edge. I briefly mentioned some data issues. The two-page handout talks about these in brief, and I just say that for the K-12 area, nearly everything is based on students and student counts, and these pupil changes are reflected in the forecast, and they're also built into the forecast base. So unlike some areas of the budget, a change in underlying pupils won't cost the legislature anything compared to base budget because those change in pupil units are built into the budget base. And that's an important concept to keep in mind in the budgeting world. Finally, in the area of fiscal notes, as Mr. Berg pointed out and Ms. Adrians have pointed out, the House generally uses fiscal notes much less than in the K-12 area than in other areas, particularly human services, and that's in part because the House has the ability, along with the Department, to simulate changes in formulas, changes in programs, and do those printouts and collect those overall budget changes themselves and aren't reliant on the relatively more complicated fiscal note process for many of those. In general, in the K-12 world, a fiscal note's necessary if there's no data behind it that's readily available to us or if there's a behavioral change where expertise at the executive branch would be helpful in trying to identify that behavioral change. Mr. Chair, we want to be sensitive to your time constraints. Ms. Adrians and I, of course, would be happy to come back and speak at length at any of your future meetings as well.
Mr. Strom, just a comment here. Your comment on base budgeting with K-12 is well noted. And when we went to special session, certainly it was the budget that was the core part of the resolution of at least this part of the budget. And the funding increase, which was 2%, I think, on the formula. So your point's an interesting one. When you're dealing with still a very large budget, $15 to $20 billion is no small amount of money. And yet you work off what we would argue is a base budget. And that's a commitment that we've made. And beyond that is where actually you're going to make changes, unless you want to do a cut of some kind inside that budget. So this is an interesting example of how to use it. Members, any? Okay, who's next? Oh, I'm sorry, do we have a question?
Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry, Rep. Suncust.
Yeah, just along that topic of the two previous presentations, and I know we're getting short on time, so I did want to bring it up a little bit, you know, the discussion on fiscal notes and the number that are used, and a little bit different here in education. It'll be interesting to see as, you know, we look to reform and improve the legislative process, that the there could be, and some would argue that there have been instances where the fiscal note process coming from the executive branch can have its own issues and swayed data and numbers. And so I'm kind of looking forward to the legislative budget office that was newly created to maybe speed up the process a little bit, but also hopefully it'll result in a reform that gives us better forecasting and actual budget numbers to deal with. And so I don't know if
because we've asked the agencies to be involved in this, and you'll see a hearing that will have the agencies come forward on the budget, and these types of questions will be answered and raised. So
excellent. I'll look forward to that further discussion.
Representative. Thank you. The fiscal note process itself might be at this an opportune time right now to look at reforming it as well.
You make another excellent point. I mean, everything is literally open here for discussion and possible change. So I would say members start making suggestions and keep making the suggestions in all of the caucuses. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See, that's the last one. Oh, I have access. This is the last. Welcome to the committee, and whoever's going to start, identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to talk about a few issues that are sort of unique to the omnibus tax bill and the process of building the omnibus tax bill at the end of session. The first point that I'm going to spend most of my time
on. Mr. Williams, you're going to work off the sheet that we have here.
Chair and members, yes. So there's a sheet in front of you that says issues unique to the omnibus tax bill. So hopefully that'll sort of, you can follow along with me as I speak. So the tax bill sort of is unique, and there's a lot heavy reliance on modeling to draft the tax bill. That requires data that's provided to us by other state agencies and governments. And I'll talk about that in more detail further on. I'd also note that there's sort of by custom a property tax division, which handles property tax and local government finance issues for the tax committee. And typically that division will move a division report first, which will ultimately be rolled into an omnibus tax bill. So there's sort of a two-step process to building a tax bill that's a little bit unique. And third is we're typically, the omnibus tax bill is typically not subject to the first and second deadline, but is often subject to the third deadline. So that means that we're kind of moving on a different timeline oftentimes than some of the other budget bills. With regard to modeling, taxes are levied and imposed in statute. Most tax expenditures have statutory appropriations, which means sort of for most proposed changes, the tax bill will not appropriate a specific amount of money for a specific program or a specific policy change. Often the fiscal cost of that change is estimated, and oftentimes that's done using modeling, but not always. So modeling is used for cost estimation purposes. It's also used to sort of do distribution analysis, so identify who might be winners and losers in the bill, how it would affect progressivity of the tax code, geographic effects of different tax changes. And it also is often used to analyze interactions between different tax proposals. So, and I believe Ms. Schill will talk later about sort of how different tax proposals interact with one another. So members, staff, the public, we use data for modeling to sort of inform the process of assembling the omnibus tax bill. We need to know how much different provisions cost and some of these distributional effects and other information that's provided in modeling to draft amendments to debate the merits of the bill. And in some cases, because of these interaction effects, it's sort of a prerequisite to assembling the tax bill that we'd be able to model it because we need to know sort of the fiscal effects of how different provisions interact with one another. And I'd also note that sort of another time constraint is that if we're modeling a new or novel policy proposal, oftentimes staff has to write new code in the models to sort of account for and sort of, you know, build an estimate of how that would work. On your sheet, I'm not going to go through it in detail. There's just two timelines for both property tax data and income tax data that is sort of used for our models. The things I'd sort of pull out from there is on the property tax side of things, it's in February that we get final levies, final certified property tax levies. And in March, there's a micro data committee of nonpartisan staff and state agency staff that project future market values and future levies. And so it's really not until, you know, February or March that we have sort of good data on sort of the current year's property tax levies and then a projection for future property tax levies. And as I sort of described earlier, a lot of that information is important to assembling the tax bill. And on the income tax side, similarly, when the February forecast comes out, we get updated parameters, things like wage growth, inflation, interest rates, those sorts of things that go into the income tax model. And in, you know, the February data is at least helpful because typically you've got the full year of tax collection data from the previous year. So a lot of taxpayers don't file until the late fall, and so that data would be incorporated in the February forecast, but it's not incorporated in the November forecast. And I'll hand it over to our fiscal staff to continue.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the
record. Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Schell, House Fiscal.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal staff as well.
And I basically work on property taxes, and Ms. Templin works with income and sales and other taxes. As Mr. Williams said, and as Mr. Strom said, state taxes are levied similar to education general aids. State taxes are levied according to statute, and most state tax expenditure are statutory appropriations. This ongoing nature of existing tax laws explain how the state can continue to collect tax revenues and distribute tax aids and credits even when the omnibus tax bill fails to become law. All of our items in our budget are forecasted. The omnibus tax bill is a culmination of proposed changes to existing state tax law. For the 2021 biennium, the 2019 February forecast estimated $46 billion in existing state tax revenues and $3.7 billion in tax aids and credits spending. The tax spreadsheet tracks each proposed change in law using data from a revenue estimate, an analysis that scores the direct fiscal impact on state tax revenues resulting from a proposed tax change in state law. The revenue estimates are prepared and published by the Department of Revenue's Tax Research Division. And last biennium, there were over 700 revenue estimates completed. Unlike fiscal notes, and I think this year we perhaps use 5 or 6 fiscal notes the whole session. Fiscal notes are completed by state agencies and reviewed by MMB. The revenue estimates are done by a small number of staff at the Department of Revenue. Given the complexity of Minnesota's tax laws and tax hearing deadlines, sometimes achieving a completed revenue estimate can include tension between the competing values of accuracy and efficiency, two of the areas that you see on Mr. McCormick's chart.
Mr. Chair, just one comment about revenue estimates. Unlike Human Services and the Education Committee, the Tax Committee operates using revenue estimates. And again, unlike fiscal notes, these revenue estimates are only reviewed by the state agency, the Department of Revenue. They're kind of vetted through that agency mainly. Occasionally, I think MMB economists are consulted. But for all the tax bills that are heard in the tax committee, they all get revenue estimates. I don't have a number for how many bills were actually heard in the tax committee, but I have over 200 revenue estimates just on state taxes alone that were completed by the small staff within the Department of Revenue.
This might be for any of you, but what would drive a, we're not in session, revenues are changing, what would drive a special session? What's the point at which the governor would be taking a look at revenues and say, as we did during the recession, there is actually a decline, and a sharp decline, and it looks like we're going to have to make some adjustments. Is there some magic percentage or number as you're monitoring this?
Mr. Chair and members, I know of no magic percentage that drives this. And I will say that when, and maybe Mr. Marks has a better sense of this, but I will say that when we had budget deficits, there were executive actions that went into effect prior to convening a special session. If you recall, there were executive budget cuts, and then when the legislature came back into session, additional measures were taken.
Mr. Chair, based on my experience, I think a special session, it's sometimes a function of negotiations, and depending on which body, how much they want to spend or how much reductions are to be made, it's kind of a factor of that, leadership decisions.
No, I fully understand that. For those of us who have lived through the recession and the changes that were being made, those were not pleasant times. So, for any of us. All right, continue.
Mr. Chair, as I continue, in addition, some of the data that we obtain through a revenue estimate includes direct fiscal impacts on state revenues. They are called interactions, and this happens when one change of a tax provision triggers a fiscal impact on one or more other taxes or a resource in a dedicated fund. And so the tax spreadsheet also tracks these interactions. And examples can go from property taxes to sales taxes to mineral taxes to a number of different taxes.
And just a comment about the interactions too, Mr. Chair. The interactions, why we mention this is because these calculations take time, and often these interactions affect other committees. For example, for the legacy committee, if there are changes in sales taxes, for example, if there is just hypothetically $100 million in exemptions, which would be a general fund reduction, there would also be an impact on the legacy side. There would be less revenue available for the legacy committee to spend. So these calculations are usually done at the very end, and they do take some time, and it's just part of the process that makes the tax committee unique in its own way.
And finally, the tax spreadsheet can also include non-tax provisions from other omnibus finance bills. Ultimately, all the fiscal impact changes are eventually combined with the base budget revenues and expenditures contained in the most recent budget forecast. Property tax aids and credits tracking is then aligned for school districts differently than aids to local governments, and so there are other activities that must occur to finally get to the amount of spending and the total revenues that we have. This concludes our presentation. Of course, we're open for questions from members now or at some other convenient
time. The general
time.
Question would be, in this last legislative session, when you're given a target number in the last 24 hours of session, how reliable then is the ability to put together a tax bill that is at whatever the target number is?
I think it's a decision of legislative leadership on what could be included or not included.
Mr. Chair, often when a target is provided and staff must assemble a bill, legislative staff is prepared and has several different scenarios that have been kind of baked and are sitting on the sidelines to be used for the final omnibus bill. What gets complicated sometimes is when there's interactions with other taxes that we may that could get missed if there is a shortage of time?
I raise it not to question your professionalism. I raise it because we push you to do things in an incredible short span of time and expect it to be correct, when in fact there simply isn't the time to do the job that needs to be done. When we're giving targets to multiple omnibus committees in the last 24 hours, and we're expecting all of these things to balance out, I think it's a wonder that anything gets done correctly. And that's not your fault. That's our fault. That's why I raise the issue of, if you're given a target within 24 hours at the end of session, and we expect it to be right, sometimes there, as we know, there have been errors. And sometimes, and I was in the retiring room this past session when there were questions raised on relatively small bills to try to understand what exactly it was that the House was about to pass or not pass on the House floor. And it's all because of that time crunch. So I'm complimenting you for doing a great job when we put you in a position where it's almost impossible to do the job. Anything else? Thank you. Thank you all. And Mr. McCormick?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that concludes our presentation. I might say in conclusion that there's really good news for the committee on legislative reform, and that is that you have some really top-notch people at Revenue, at MMB, legislative staff who can implement this very complex. If you have an idea, the very complex reforms you come up with can be implemented. You also have some bad news, and that is that any change to the state's executive legislative budget-making process is literally going to involve hundreds of people who work to create this budget. And so, yes, we got brilliant, bright people who can enact a reform, but also you're going to make a change in this area, you're going to have to probably adjust statutes. You're going to get buy-in from the Senate. You're going to get buy-in from both the technical professional people at MMB and Revenue and from the governor and also from his political team. And there's going to be costs and there's going to be trade-offs because you're going to move your budget along this four-point continuum. You're going to do things that are slightly more efficient and a little bit less accurate, slightly more transparent, but a little harder for legislators to sign on to. The current system developed over multiple years in a layered way, and I think that's what we've tried to present to you. A new system can develop in the same way. We can make changes. It's just going to be a lot easier to do reforms that maybe affect only the House floor or the House procedures than something in this area. And that's our presentation and what we've brought to the table.
All right. And members, we intend to have more hearings, and there'll be multiple hearings, as you've already understood, from a variety of sources. So hopefully we will be taking all of this into consideration. And with that, we've run past our time, but that's all right. I'll adjourn the meeting and look forward to your input, and then keep monitoring us, and we'll let you know what's coming up next. So thank you. Meeting adjourned.